And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
And I'm Grace.
And I'm sick. I mean, I'm David.
Yeah, you're hella sick, David. We could have told you that. Oh, that's sick.
Hopefully, yeah, actually like ill type sick. But hopefully it's not an issue, and sorry if it is, but I should be good.
Somehow I will be restraining my desire to just talk about the Godzilla movie that we saw last night, and we'll actually talk about Star Trek if we're lucky today.
Why,
good Lord, if we are lucky.
Why are there no giant lizard monsters in Star Trek? I would love that.
Gorn.
Yeah,
well, I said giant.
I guess. Although, interesting point of fact, I just found out today, speaking of things that are giant, apparently the whole idea for there being whales on the Enterprise, like, I thought that was a Gene Roddenberry idea. Apparently that came from a guy named Rick Sternbacher. It wasn't a Roddenberry thing, which, you know, makes me respect Roddenberry a little bit more. And the reason I know this is because apparently he
was
involved.
Not by much, but a little more.
Look, at least he didn't think whales on the spaceship was a good idea, okay? This was something that this guy had, and he was like, I want there to be whales on the Enterprise, and he put it in his, like, technical schematics that they made him, you know, that they had him draw. And then, like, they get mentioned in that one episode, The Empath, where Geordi talks about dolphins, and we don't really know what he was talking about.
I still like to look at this as more potential to draw parallels between Star Trek and the life aquatic. That's what I'm taking away from this.
Plus, they might have, like, one of those Johnny Mnemonic dolphins, like, on the ship somewhere, like, handling all their computer functions.
That would actually be pretty cool.
Alright, so we have two emails, and the first one is a nice little one, and I will go ahead and read it. It is from someone who goes by the handle of the Pastel Nerd, as opposed to the, like, I don't know, the Watercolors Nerd, or the Vibrant Tone Nerd.
The Jewel Tones Nerd.
Well,
I want to claim that one, okay? Yeah.
All right, Grace is the Jewel Tones Nerd. I'll be the Watercolors Nerd, and David is the Pearlescent Nerd. All right, we got this. Okay, so the subject is Love the Show. Message. I'm a new listener who was introduced to it by the Trekkie Feminist blog. I love it. I figure I'll share a Star Trek story with you. When I was a kid, even though I regularly watched TNG with my father, and he often watched repeats of TOS, I did not watch TOS until I was an adult because I was scared of one of the aliens in the closing credits. Which is
Aww.
Fair. I was
scared
by
the big scary-headed alien? That guy's spooky.
Well,
yeah.
I'm thinking that might have been the salt vampire.
Not gonna lie, the salt vampire creeps me out. Like, to this day, I am disturbed by the salt vampire.
Either way, we know where you're coming from, Pastel Nerd.
Now, we have a second email, which is from Datalogan, and it is an audio message, as Datalogan is wont to do. David, would you mind playing it for us?
Yep, here we go.
Direct from the database in Bremerton, Washington, it's Datalogan's Datalog.
One is my name. The other is not.
2014, May 22nd. I watched the original series episode The Changeling recently, and I recently listened to your podcast about masculinity in Star Trek. What really got me thinking this time watching the episode was that little bit at the end where Kirk refers to Nomad as his son, the Doctor. It's one of those classic original series joke endings where he's not really serious about it. But the line does take on a bit of a whole new meaning when you realize, after watching Star Trek 2, that Kirk does have a son at the time that he says that line. So at about this time in the original series, I guess David is about 9 or 10 years old. And of course, Kirk's not in his son's life very much because the mother didn't want him to be, mostly because of his career choice. But it made me wonder, maybe Kirk does, at least occasionally, think about the lost connection he has with his son, and possibly even hope that his son will grow up to be a doctor. Which, of course, turns out to be a little funny because David does turn out to be a doctor later in life, although not the kind that he was referring to Nomad being a doctor. It's just one new way of thinking about this whole dynamic where Kirk is having this time in his life where he knows he has a son, but he's not actively participating in his son's life. And maybe he's feeling some of the pangs of that, and in some ways reaches out for surrogate sons or surrogate children. I don't really think that Kirk saw Nomad as a child of his, but Nomad did see him as a father figure. And going through that whole episode in his life, it might have reminded Kirk of his real-life son. So maybe, in a little way, Kirk does embrace the concept of no man as a son, because he is looking for that surrogate child. You can also see it, of course, in the way he embraces his crew as his children that he's taking care of. But Kirk certainly has limits to the surrogate children that he's looking for in his life, because he's actually not that good with real children, as we saw in Charlie X and The Children Shall Lead and Miri, or even in Operation Annihilate. You know, we see Kirk is fine being an uncle to Peter, but not willing to be the person who raises Peter. Granted, mostly because his career choice, which is very important to him, is really incompatible with raising kids. The same issue he has with his own son, David, who's already out there. Another way of putting it is that Kirk may be one of those kind of people who likes the idea of having had kids, but doesn't necessarily want to have them in the sense of raising them. You know, he likes the older kids, the ones that aren't so kid-like. Really, I sort of share that trait with Kirk, I think. The part of fatherhood that I really find myself enjoying is when I can have a conversation with one of my kids, and I can really see them learning something new or growing as intellectual people, i.e. as adults, and not necessarily the kid stuff. You know, I'm not so big into the diaper changes or temper tantrums, of course, but also not so much into the play and catch, you know, that other parents might be into doing with their kids and sharing the fun moments of the child. Anyway, so that's just a new perspective that I've recently developed on that small little line in the episode The Changeling, and maybe a little bit also on what I think of my own personal role as a father and a man in this culture. Data out.
So thanks, Data Logan, for that voice message. Had some very interesting things to say about Kirk and like how he was kind of a father figure with Nomad, which is an interesting something I had not thought about, and how like that had some dramatic irony several years later when we got to Wrath of Khan.
Pastel Nerd for writing into us too.
Yes, thank you, Pastel Nerd. And as if I needed another reason to keep getting Jera on the show, because I mean, we love having Jera, and apparently she gets listeners. So, you know, win for everyone around. Now, before we get into our main topic for today, I had a question that I wanted to put to both Grace and David. And this came up as I was actually listening to another Star Trek podcast. And so you can tell this podcast has reached a new level of meta, because I come to this podcast to talk about things that I was thinking of while I was listening to other podcasts. But this
Podception?
We have reached Podception. We have to go deeper. I was listening to the Post-Atomic Horror podcast, which doesn't sound like a Star Trek podcast, but it is. And, you know, they're doing the kind of, the traditional, we're going to go and review every episode. And they're pretty far. They're about halfway through Deep Space Nine right now.
Nice.
Yeah, and they've been doing it for a while, and they do two episodes. They do two Star Trek episodes for one podcast episode. But I like them. It's a good show. I'd recommend you listen to it if you haven't already. I enjoy it a lot. It's weird, because they are more critical of Star Trek than I am, which is unusual.
What?
Yeah, I know, right? It's weird, but it's interesting. You know, I'm just like, how could you say that, you guys? But then I'm like, all right, well, there are probably people who like Enterprise and Voyager who think that when they listen to me. So, you know, I keep an open mind, even when they're saying something was bad that I think was really good. But the question in particular came up because they reviewed just recently the episode Past Tense, which is a Deep Space Nine episode where they go back in time to the Bell Riots, which take place in what is still our future. I think it's like 2040 or something in San Francisco.
I'm invisible. Oh, wait, sorry. That's one of my favorite parts of that two-parter is Clint Howard as the, you know, the guy that sees aliens, but they're the good aliens. So. I'm sorry, go ahead.
We're okay, aliens. So they really, really didn't like that episode. Like, I was surprised by how much they hated that episode. I was just like, okay, this is unusual. I tend to think of this episode as being, like, an average Deep Space Nine episode. Like, it's not the best they ever did, but it's okay. But I was listening, and I was like, all right, some of these things make sense, and some of these critiques are legitimate. Like, why do they not care what happened to Sisko and Bashir's comm badges? That's kind of reasonable. It's kind of weird that they would just leave comm badges floating around in the past.
Like you do.
Yeah, which is a kind of a thing in Star Trek, they pointed out. We leave comm packages all over the place. But one thing that they asked, which...
They're like Skittles, you just find them everywhere.
Was a big thing that they seemed to have a problem with was that they were wondering what was the point of this episode, because it's kind of an episode focusing on the problem of poverty and, like, homelessness. And they were like, there doesn't... They were of the opinion that there wasn't really much point to this episode because... Everyone agrees those are bad things, and there's not like a pro-poverty, you know, lobby out there that needs to be convinced that they're in the wrong. And so I was wondering what you guys think of that kind of episode, because there are a few in Star Trek, right? Like there's the Hunted, which is an episode about how badly war veterans get treated when they come back to civilian society, and you know, there's not really any group out there who is for the mistreatment of veterans. I was just wondering, do you guys feel like that there's is that do you guys think there's a place for that kind of episode where it's not like discussing like a really contentious issue, but like it's still a problem, but it's not, but there's not a lot of disagreement on it. It's just like we don't know how to deal with that problem.
Right. At the same time, I don't think it's supposed to be like a sort of, this is a thing that people think is bad. Let's talk about how this is a bad thing. It's more like a sort of moral call to action or an expression of moral outrage at the level of apathy that comes with these problems. And I think that's been kind of a recurring thing on Star Trek. You see it a lot. And it's not like saying this thing is bad. Well, it is, but obviously it's a bad thing. No one would think it's a good thing. But just because we're talking about the bad thing doesn't mean we're saying, can you believe people don't know about this bad thing? It's more like drawing attention to the thing. That wasn't very well worded.
It's okay, Grace. I think I got what you were talking about.
It's more of a moral call to outrage or a call to action. Take that as you will.
Fair enough.
Do we really need a Star Trek episode with Abraham Lincoln?
Need more Abraham Lincoln personally.
There's different like goals or, you know, types of Star Trek episodes, and some are the definite, like, you know, the moral to the story type episode. Some are just fun, and some are just, you know, pose, you know, interesting scenarios. Some are just sci-fi tales. The thing I liked the past tense. I mean, it's early in the season. I mean, early in the series, maybe what? See, I haven't looked it up yet, but it's like what?
I'm guessing early season three.
I would have thought two or three. So season three. So they're still, you know, in the early stages. They're still finding their voice and their, you know, path and all that. But I liked it. It was a two-part episode, if I remember right. And the way I looked at it was, it wasn't necessarily saying, hey, people, you should think poverty is bad. I looked at it as it's another tale that we've seen in like TOS and other things about the haves and the have-nots and like why that disparity shouldn't be a case. And we, like, most people already know that. But the other way I looked at it was, it was a pivotal point in Earth history. You know, it was a turning point or a milestone or just a flag on the timeline marker that was like, you know, an interesting time in the development. And then put the Star Trek crew, like put our people in that moment and having to be on both sides of it, because Dax is in with like the more, you know, the haves side of it, you know, with the media and the broadcasts, and she's, you know, they're all dressed nicely and everything. And then there's the poor side inside the zone that basically like a giant city sized internment, you know, basically type thing. And I thought it was an interesting look at, you know, the past of Star Trek, but still our future, because we don't always see that. A lot of times we would see most of the time Star Trek would either go to the present, you know, Star Trek going to the past, but it's really our present, right? We've seen that several times where they just either walk around San Francisco or Paramount or Lot or whatever, or they go to the way distant past, like Time Zero, where you're looking at Mark Twain or whatever. So I thought that was an interesting take that I liked, that it's like Star Trek past, but our future. But I just thought it was an interesting story overall. And then, you know, another glimpse of like the haves and the have-nots. And those are always interesting tales and, you know, showing just that happens. But it was like a point where also Star Trek making a point that everybody or a lot of people would say riots and that's bad, you know, we could even extend that further to say terrorism. But just like rioting is bad, that's wrong, that's never a good thing because of, you know, fire and destruction and breaking windows. But then it shows that that was a turning point, that, you know, after that riots, things got better, things changed, and it moved closer towards the utopian-ish future that we see in TNG DS9. So I liked it. I didn't really, I mean, obviously it's early on. There, you know, every episode could be better, but it had some cool characters, and we got to see, you know, Sisko and people being like outside of their normal, like they're not in uniform talking about technobabble. They're having to be incognito or undercover. And I liked it. I give it, you know, big thumbs up.
Also, it's an interesting kind of look at the road to the Federation. And like you were saying, that it really did get bad before it got better. And it's interesting to see that. What am I trying to say? It's interesting to see that shown and put on screen, that it wasn't always, you know, great for humanity, even before the Federation and before we had like big scale war on the intergalactic level, we still had problems of our own.
Yeah, no doubt. One of the things that I like about that episode and other, and also episodes like The Hunted, are that I kind of feel like those episodes that are calling attention to a problem that is not so much a problem of a, whether or not people think it's a problem. Like, you know, you have episodes like Reunion, or no, not Reunion, excuse me, Rejoined, which is Dax and her former wife. And that episode is about, you know, homosexual equality. And that is a problem, right? And we do have a lot of people who don't think that equality for people who are not heterosexual should exist, right? Like, those are people who need to be convinced. But this is a different kind of problem, right? Where we have, nobody wants there to be poverty, but we have vastly different ideas of how we should go about trying to fix it. And I'm not going to pretend I know what the answer is. But at the same time, I do feel like even though it's not a problem that anyone thinks is a good thing, it's still a problem that exists and we haven't solved it yet. And a lot of
but there's also like a different layer or tinge to it, because it wasn't just, oh, there's poor people. And some people would say, well, just pull yourselves up by your bootstraps or just put in the work. This was almost, to me, a variation, like obviously a different whole scenario, but it kind of reminded me of the TOS episode with the cloud miners, how the people up in the clouds were like, you know, posh and luxurious, and the people down on the surface were doing the grunt work in the mines, getting sick from the ore and, you know, living poor. But the disparity, so there you have like the haves and the have-nots, but it was kind of like the people in the cloud city let me put it this way. The people down in the mine couldn't advance. They couldn't pull themselves up by the bootstraps and get to the cloud city. Like, they were being kept in that level. And that was the thing with that episode, was that, you know, the poor people were kept in like a walled area. And like, they were, you could kind of have to see that the Star Trek crew, the DS9 crew, kind of had to convince the mainstream, the haves, to be like, hey, these people are like this because of the being kept in this position, give them a chance, and they just want to work. You know, they want the opportunity. So it's not just, oh, how sad, there's poor people, but like people that are being kept in a condition and they have to like basically riot to say, hey, this has to change. Just give us a chance and accept us, and, you know, we'll not be the way we are. Because, you know, so that was a different layer to it, that it was not just, oh, how sad, there's rich, there's poor people.
Right. And also, like, just from a practical standpoint, like, homelessness to me is a solvable problem. Like, we have, I believe, more empty houses in this country than we have homeless people.
Oh my God. It's golf courses. Like, there should be no golf courses while there's homeless people. Okay, go ahead.
So, I mean, I'm not necessarily calling for radical redistribution of property, you know, despite my long-haired socialist hippie roots, but I do think that most people, when they look at the numbers, would agree that we could solve homelessness if we tried hard enough. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting episode.
I'm going to definitely get behind that idea, Oren. I'm going to definitely agree with you on that.
It also spoke to me just a little bit, because I don't know how it is in other places, even though I've lived in Seattle for like 4 years now. I don't entirely know how it works here, but I know in Hawaii, where I lived, we do have a fair number of homeless people, and it's not as bad there as it is other places, because Hawaii doesn't ever get cold. But what Hawaii will do sometimes, which is just this weird thing that various city governments and sometimes the state government will do, is try to herd the homeless population around, where they'll pass all these laws making it really difficult for homeless people to camp out in, say, this particular park, because someone has decided they don't like homeless people being in this park. And it's like, well, the homeless people aren't going to disappear just because you said they couldn't live in that park, right? Like, they're still there, and they just move to another part of the island, and then then that part of the island passes a law saying that there can't be homeless people here, and the homeless people who stay get arrested, and so then they go somewhere else, and it's this weird cycle of moving homeless people around, and it really serves no purpose. And just, I don't know, for some reason the whole sanctuary idea really spoke to me, because it's not solving the problem, it's just putting it somewhere we can't see it.
Right, exactly. I know that feeling too. Sorry, David.
No, go ahead.
I grew up in Portland, which has actually one of the highest homeless populations in America, if I'm remembering right. But you literally would see a small tent city under every bridge at night. And the fact that Portland is becoming, you know, it's moving up in the world these days, but the homeless people aren't going anywhere. They don't have anywhere else to go. They have to stay in a reasonable climate where they aren't going to freeze to death at night. And how are you going to get out of Portland, really? So that's been something that's been kind of at the cultural forefront there, the fact that there is still this massive homeless population, and just because the city is rising up in prominence and there's a lot of money being tossed around does not mean the problems are all being solved. Ugh, sad day.
And then from the chat room, Curiously Queer had a good point that Memory Alpha says that the Attica prison riots were also an inspiration for the episode, and in 1994 that was the 20th anniversary, so they might have been touching on that and bringing it into a Star Trek, you know, scenario, because the Sanctuary Districts, it was basically I kind of have shades of, like, you know, in the prison riots is one thing, but then also there was elements that I felt when I was watching it of almost like an Indian reservation, where it's like, well, just put these people over here. They're out of the way. They're walled
Call
in.
Call it good. Pretend like they're not there.
Right. And at the same time,
out of sight, out of mind. Yeah.
And at the same time, the people in there are being subjugated. Like, they can't just be like, you're only in there for a month while you get a job and you save up and then you could get out. The people in there were kind of stuck in there, almost like a prison. Or, you know, there was really no advancement or opportunity to get out, and that's why they had to riot. Excuse me.
Sorry.
There was a lot to that episode that I thought didn't come off way too preachy, but was like touching on some, you know, real issues, some serious issues, not just a happy, fun, campy episode, which is cool. I like the campy ones too, but especially, you know, with DS9 going in darker tones and more seriousness at times, and then, you know, trying to make that a bad situation, and then Star Trek making it better, you know. I mean, our characters making a situation better, like, you know. So I really appreciated that episode, especially for being so early on in a young series.
Yeah, it was definitely a gutsy move to put that so early on. Well, to do it at all, but also to do it when they're still establishing the show so much.
All right. Well, thank you guys for indulging me on that. I just wanted to talk about it and see, get that thought, because I was having this conversation in my mind, and I was like, I need to have this with somebody else, like someone who can talk back to me. So for now, we will advance to our main topic for today, which is the fan animation show Star Trek Aurora, which David.
Fanimation.
Yeah. So David, this was your idea, so thank you for bringing this. I'd seen it before, like a long time ago, but thank you for bringing it to our attention again for this show. So at the moment,
yeah. Well, just real quick, it's something that I've enjoyed. Like, when I first found it, I watched it, and then I immediately like started it over again and watched it again. But it's something that, like, you know, several months or even a year will go by, and I think about it, and I go back to it and I watch it again, and it's just something that I think was really well done and interesting, and so I wanted to bring it up for at least for one of our episodes.
So just so everybody knows, since this is a thing that I think a lot of people haven't seen, and we are going to be like discussing it and analyzing it, so I am going to give a fairly detailed plot plot synopsis here. So I hope, you know, if you don't want to be spoiled, I would recommend not listening to this episode, going and listening to it. It's Star Trek Aurora. And it's just, you know, all other things aside, I do think it's worth watching. But at the same time, I don't think knowing what happens makes it less fun to watch. It's not that kind
of... Well, right. It's like, even if we're talking about the plot and the story and the characters, and so in a way that's like spoilers, I think it's done well enough in the writing, in the voicing of it, the visuals, like all throughout, it would still be fun to watch and, you know, worth watching, even if you know what happens. So I recommend everybody check it out, at least, you know, after the show.
All right, so here we go. I've never done this before on the air, but I'm going to try to go for a Mission Log style episode recap. Because this is the pilot episode that we're looking at, which at the moment is most of what exists. All right. We start off with the SS Aurora, crewed by Captain Kara Carpenter and First Officer T'Ling, a Vulcan. The episode starts off with the two of them just shooting the breeze, some jokes about T'Ling being the only crew member, you know, even though they're supposed to be, she's talking about there being a crew, mainly to establish that this is not a Starfleet ship. We also find out that Kara doesn't like the word cannibal, though we don't yet know why. We get a flashback with Kara on board her family cargo ship, which is lost, and full of her big happy family. I'm sure this ends well. I was wrong!
It has to.
Kara
no!
goes out and...
Who could have seen this coming?
Kara goes out into a spacesuit to fix a problem and sees a Romulan ship, though she doesn't know at the time what a Romulan is. Despite the freighter being unarmed, the Romulans fire at it, because they're jerks. Kara is the only survivor. Back in the present, the Aurora is unloading her cargo at a non-Federation station. What they're being paid in is anybody's guess. We get some back and forth between Kara and T'Ling, and they talk about how their ship is somehow able to make cargo runs much faster than anyone else. Cargo offloaded, it's time for booze! Kara insists on going to a bar,
yeah.
Though T'Ling...
I said, oh yeah, time for some drinks.
It's crunk o'clock.
Kara insists on going to a bar, though T'Ling would prefer to drink on the ship. They get to the bar via a promenade with ads so gaudy they would make Quark wince. A couple in
well
the bar...
Said.
Couple... Well, I mean, I think, you know, that like, Orion dancing girl ad and, like, the guy with the arms, and just, those are some pretty glitzy ads they got going on there.
Where are they? Are they in, like, space Times Square or something? You gotta wonder.
In the bar, a couple of fellas come over, and Kara thinks this might lead to a little first contact, if you know what I mean. No? Okay, then. The lead fella's name is Randy Jacobs, and it turns out he's a total jerk. Going
space
about on
space Texan also.
Yeah, and space.
Space hillbillies.
Going on about how our hero is Cannibal Kara. I wonder what that could possibly mean. Whatever it means, Kara doesn't like it. When Jacob won't cut it out, T'Ling gives him the most satisfying Vulcan neck pinch ever, and then they amscray. Back on Aurora,
yeah, that's
we
about right, yeah.
That's basically what happens. Back on Aurora, we get another flashback, and Kara explains that with her family dead, she was trapped on the ship for weeks with no food, and she had to rig up some kind of something to drain proteins out of their bodies. There's a bit of an awkward silence. Okay, then. The
yep.
next day, after a nice breakfast complete with Vulcan spice tea, Aurora lifts off with her cargo and flies straight out into a nebula, which seems kind of odd. Suddenly, Jacob the Jerk is back with his ship, the Lone Star. Excuse me. Lone Star!
Yep! We were doing that the whole time.
Demanding to know how they can go do a cargo run in so little time. But it seems like his shields are going to make the nebula explode. Way to go, Jacob the Jerk. That was Kara's secret, by the way, was being able to fly through the nebula without making it explode, which turns out is very useful. So the nebula explodes, and both ships try to escape. Cut to Kara sitting naked on a transporter pad with a woman who seems to be an exact twin, except this one is wearing a Starfleet uniform. Cut to the next scene, where Kara has found some clothes, and the captain, it's actually not the captain I realized after I wrote this, it's actually the science officer, is explaining what happened. You guessed it, folks. Kara has been transported to another dimension. Because of something, 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 this has to do with warp fields and transporters and explosions, oh my.
Transporter accident. Let's just call it a transporter accident.
Look, you gotta call a transporter accident a transporter accident.
Like you do.
It's a little bit more science-y than that, but it is.
Transporter accident!
Yeah, okay.
They. I'm not gonna pretend that I couldn't remember exactly how they described it on the episode, but they do go into more detail than that. Talking with her double, Kara finds out that in this universe there was no Romulan ship, and that her family is still alive. She also finds out that being in this universe is killing her. You win some, you lose some. After being taken to sickbay, Kara overhears two more important things. One, her family ship is nearby, and two, her double is on report, possibly for not being the most stellar example of a Starfleet officer. Kara, being the goal-oriented sort, sedates her double and steals the shuttlecraft to go see her family. Aboard the family ship, Kara has an emotional reunion with her family, except her father, who seems to be avoiding her for some reason. She also finds out that her double, who they think she is, has apparently been making an ass of herself for years and alienated all the people she cares about. Well, awkward. This is a little much for Kara. She goes up to the observation dome when her father finally decides to make an appearance. Despite the whole alternate Kara alienating everyone who cares about her thing, they manage to have a loving reunion as well. But then the jig is up. Alternate Kara arrives with security to arrest our Kara for stealing a shuttle. Fun twist, though, it turns out that the family likes our Kara better and invites her to stay. Unfortunately, that's the moment when she gets another attack of being from a different universe, and this time it's going to kill her. Alternate Kara is not completely heartless, though. She's brought a device to send our Kara back to the original universe, complete with emotional goodbyes. As they stand on the transporter pad, our Kara tells her double to stop messing up her life if it's not too much trouble. Inter-universe transport is a complete success, even restoring Kara's pigtails, which had lost structural integrity in an earlier scene. It seems that the Aurora has been... It seems that the Aurora has been frozen in time for 2 days while she was gone, so T'ling is none the wiser. To show that he's not a complete jerk, Jacob the Jerk has apparently been waiting for them. You know, just in case their ship was frozen in time and one of them was transported to an alternate universe for 2 days. Damage to the ship aside...
As it happens.
You know, not an unlikely thing to happen in Star Trek. Damage to the ship aside, Kara is just happy to be alive and for having seen her family. On that note, we get a nice cut over to the other universe, where alternate Kara is having a nice dinner with her family. The episode leaves off with a final shot of Kara, T'ling, and Jacob the Jerk having some drinks together. The end. Whew.
Yay.
Okay, I'm done talking for the rest of the episode. You guys can handle it from here.
All right.
So what we learned in this episode is that people in Federation space are jerks. Apparently,
this isn't a new concept, Oren. Not at all.
Jerks survive into the future. And that's what. Well, the thing I like.
They weren't able to strain out that DNA cluster. Great.
That was a good nutshell version, like plot synopsis. And there's more to it. There's moments. There's the little bits of humor. There's some, you know, emotional parts to it. So I definitely recommend still watching it. It's not like, oh, well, now I know what happens. I definitely watch it. For one, it's set in the original series universe. So, you know, it's actually a Constitution class ship, and we get to see some classic TOS style outfits and so that was cool. Another thing that I liked about it was it's in the Star Trek universe. We see Starfleet and you know, Starfleet ships and officers, but a good chunk of it is civilian life and, you know, people who live in Federation space and have to deal with the Federation and Starfleet. But it would almost be like the freighter captains and the, you know, taxi people and the people on the independent star bases. And so I just like that aspect of it, that it gave us, it felt like it expanded on the universe, and we got to see, it's almost like the Lower Decks episode type idea, but then extended further to, like, you know, we see Cassidy Yates on DS9 and she's a freighter captain, but we never, like, go on an adventure with her or spend time in her ship seeing what she has to deal with. Because, you know, you might think, oh, well, it's just boring, just hauling, like a trucker, just hauling cargo. But I'm sure they run into things, too. You know, space is, there's a lot out there in space. And so I liked it for that. And it's just well written. What did you think of it? Well, first off, was this the first time you'd seen it, Grace, when we talked?
It was the first time I'd seen it and the first time I'd heard of it. And I'm going to agree with you. I thought it was pretty well written. It was really interesting. It was a lot to cram together in an introductory episode, though. Like, to have the big, yeah, she kind of had to eat her family to survive thing, and the whole she's a sole survivor and this is what her life is like now thing, plus the whole, you know, switching universes plot. It was a lot to cram together in an hour, and it made the whole thing feel a little manic. But that said, it was still interesting. We still got some fun dialogue, but... can we talk for a minute about the animation?
Well, just real quick, before you, what you said kind of addresses something. It's like 53 minutes, so it's almost a full hour, and it moves. There's a lot packed into it. There's not really much downtime. It's just, you know, one thing after one scene and act after another. But in reality, we watched it as a complete thing, right? All together, 1 hour. It actually, some little background for it. It was released, let me put it this way. It took 6 years to make it. It was done by one guy.
Gotcha.
It was done by one guy, Tim Vining, I think is his name. I'd have to look it again. But it was done in over 6 years, and he released it in several parts. And there was like months in between of him putting out part one to part two to part. And so there was people that were like anxious for the next segment of it. And then, of course, you know, once it was completed, they strung it all together, and we get the full 1 hour version of it. So I kind of wondered, I found it after it was all assembled as one big unit. I kind of wondered how it would have been to like see it as parts and then have to wait, you know, several months or week, you know, I'm sure more than weeks because, but like you said, if you wanted to talk about the animation, this whole thing was written, animated, and like basically directed, cameras, everything, by one guy. So does that make you think any different of it, and or the animation and the direction that it's, you know, that type of production?
A little bit. It's definitely an ambitious project, and knowing that really makes you just go, wow, that's a lot of work for a single person to put into it, and no wonder it took 6 years. And also just stepping back a bit, I think I might have actually, I think it might have format-wise worked better as the serial thing rather than all just pushed together for an hour. It felt like it had too much rising and falling actions going with the plot at once and just happening for a single hour. So I do think it would have worked better as the shorts on their own to just, you know, marathon watch them rather than just watch them all as one big thing, if that makes sense.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you get that with some older novels, actually, because they were written as serials, and so there had to be a thing at the end of each chapter to make you want to read the next one. So, like, why do all these chapters end on cliffhangers? That's
right.
Weird.
It strikes me as something that works really well as a serial. Not to say it doesn't work, but I just think that is sort of the content that should dictate the form. But yeah, let's talk about the animation. It uses Poser, which is, I know from experience, a really difficult program to use. And it's made specifically for, you know, animation. It has a lot of pre-made figures that makes it very easy to, well, not easy, but it makes it easier to work with than your standard animation program in the sense that you have a lot of models to work with already, and it saves you a lot of time in having to build and create characters and to, you know, have to hand draw things out. That was actually one of the ways in which I thought the animation suffered a little bit, is that with Poser, you come with a level of kind of uncanny valley, which both served them well in the fact that most of the characters are human, they're human-like, and, you know, it's very easy to tell what you're looking at, but at the same time, it makes everything a little visually awkward, and when you have, like, those preset figures you're working with, there's a level of uniformity to it that you don't get when you're using like live actors, which probably would have been a lot more expensive and a lot more time consuming. But again, it adds to that sort of uncanny level of it. But I thought that it was still very impressive what they were able to do to it. And you really see Gil-wise really evolved throughout the course of even this first episode. You can really see this person animating, sort of getting into the flow better. And getting better at having the characters, you know, gesticulate, move. But at the same time, the walk cycle still felt really awkward. There's lots of over-exaggerated butt shaking in the walk.
There's a lot of hip swaying. But by the same token, like, I mean, first of all, I don't have an animation background, so animation looks like magic to me.
Oh, Oren. You sweet little child.
It's just wizardry as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, I liked the animation, and part of that is because, like, I sat through Babylon 5 Season 1 animation, okay? And that was terrible animation. And that was, like, on a professional budget. And even, like, the first season of Clone Wars, which I really like, has some not good animation. Like, not even kind of good. And again, those were...
Dude, I watched through all of Beast Wars. I know what you're talking about here. I'm just saying this as someone who's worked with Poser before.
Right, right. So, like, on the one hand, it's true that there is some awkwardness in the animation on Aurora, but on the other hand, I tend to be very forgiving of it, just because it's like, you know, I've seen worse in professional productions. So, you know, I'm willing to give the guy a lot of credit. Also, I do have a bit of a sympathetic feeling, because as someone who occasionally tries to put on a radio show, which has no visual element, I still have to deal with it taking forever and having volunteer actors who aren't professionals. So I was willing to give a lot of leeway on the animation, even if it did sometimes stretch into Uncanny Valley territory. I did really like the look of the ship. I got to give them that.
Yeah, and I kind of felt the same way that, you know, I've been a fan of computer animation basically since the 80s, and we had the original, you know, birth of animation, and then, you know, all the different versions of, like, Lightwave and, you know, Toaster and all these programs that have come out over the years. So I've definitely seen worse, and then obviously we've seen better, but then there's other animations where, you know, it's really bad. And so in this case, I was like, okay, I'll give it the leeway. I'll go with it, because it was definitely better than what I've seen. And if you really look at it, because, like, when I watch it, you know, start to finish, I get into the story and I just, you know, go into that universe and the world and everything. But a couple of times when I look at it, I did look at it like critiquing the lighting and the hair and this and that. And if you watch from the beginning to the end,
which you can do with just about any fan production, honestly.
Yeah, once you've seen it twice or, you know, a few times, then you can look at it, like, you know, from the production standpoint. And if you watch it, there's actually some improvement along the way. And
oh, definitely.
There was an interview that the creator did where he said that, because it took 6 years, that his techniques improved and he got faster and better at some things, but that he even actually, you know, started incorporating motion capture. It was a very rudimentary form of motion capture, but that he was trying to improve it along the way. And it was, like, you know, several years ago. So I just went with it because, you know, video games have had bad animation and you know, movement acting. And so I recognized it right off the bat, but I just kind of set that aside because, like Warren said, like, I've looked at animation programs and I can't do that. And, you know, I could draw really good, but that's not a animated 3D model. And again, this is an off the shelf type software. He did go to films to art school, but he wasn't a professional animator, you know, at Pixar or at some of these studios. So I gave him credit for doing as well as he did. And to me, I thought I could have excused bad animation if the story and the characters were well done. If it was this same level of animation that we see in it, but the characters and the story was, like, crap, I would have just, you know, bailed on it right off the bat.
Yeah,
but
I would have been done within the first, like, minute and a half.
Now, that was actually something that I wanted to mention, because I can only, you know, I mean, the animation, I think I'm going to put, I would give it a solid B as far as animation goes. Like,
yeah,
it's not,
I'd go for that.
It's not like the greatest.
I've seen projects with bigger budgets do a lot worse, so.
Yeah, like, it's not the greatest, but it also will not interfere with my enjoyment of the story.
No.
Except for, like, there are one or two, but most of it is just like, yeah, that's animation. That's awesome. I'm going to watch that. But,
well, and
so
just real quick, the thing I want to say was, when we say what we're talking about, it's pretty much the face, you know, the body movements, the faces. But, like, well, he did a really good job with, like, blocking and setting up the cameras and the angles and everything like that. So when we're saying animation, it's not everything. It's pretty much the motion and the body's movement and stuff. But what were you going to say, Oren?
I was just going to say, with the plot, I think that he does a really good job with the family reunion aspect. That's my favorite part of the episode, and I really enjoy it. The whole, like, cannibalism subplot, that I didn't think was terribly necessary. like, I can see why they did it now, because it, as you said, it was released in serial, so there needed to be something exciting happening in the early serial, like, you know, in the back when this was still different parts. But the cannibalism aspect feels a little bit distracting. Like, I think it would have worked better if it had just been her family was dead. But once she actually goes to the alternate universe and, like, reunites with her family, I really like that part. And maybe just because I enjoy the dramatic irony of the, in one universe, your family died, and on the other universe, they lived, but you became kind of a loser.
Well, like, the thing, when I first saw this, I obviously had seen most of Next Generation and stuff like that. So that kind of thought, it reminded me of the episode Parallels, where we see, you know, the crazy beard Riker, where the Borg has decimated the Federation right next to, you know, all the different enterprises. And so, like, alternate realities where it's the same people, but they've been through different experiences. They're in different places and that type of thing. And just, I think one, he wrote the story all first. So the story was written completely first, and then he went to animate it. So there was some, in one interview, there were some questions about, you know, what was the story, just servicing animation, or was it, you know, how did he do it? And so he wrote the whole story first and then animated. I kind of thought of it as, you know, the whole story isn't so focused on the cannibal thing. Like, that's a big chunk of it. But then it's about, like, the alternate realities and, you know, coming to peace with family. But I thought, you know, early on, it kind of made the character sympathetic. Like, you would, you know, it set a tone for the character, how, like, you know, she went through some very tough experiences, but then the character is really optimistic and, you know, light. You know, it's not like somebody who's brooding and emo all the time. But I also just thought that was interesting. Like, we haven't really seen that in Trek or a lot of sci-fi, where it's like, but it felt very sci-fi-ish and, like, you know, an interesting dilemma that, like, you know, in the future that, you know, because if it was done in the past or a submarine story or even the present day, if you're locked in a metal box with no food, or, you know, if the food ran out in 2 weeks, you're dead. But in this case, there was a technological, you know, solution. And that even right there could be talked about, like, you got your family member, almost like the soccer players or the people that get stuck up in a mountain and they're stranded and no hope of rescue, like, and some people die, like, are you going to...
Alive, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
that's the movie.
Would you go there? Right, and that's happening, like, that was based on a true story, it's happened other times, so that alone is, like, an interesting dilemma or story.
Look at the Donner Party, yeah.
Like, would you go there? Could you go there? Like, and she even mentions it, like, in one part, when she tells, like, why did that guy call her cannibal, Kara? And when she's explaining that to her, to Ling... T'Ling even says, like, she goes, well, would Vulcans do that? And T'Ling is saying, you know, the drive to stay alive is strong, even in Vulcans. Like, you know, so it didn't, like, bother me in a way that, like, well, they should have not covered that in the story. It just was an interesting, you know, layer to the character, an interesting scenario. And if they focused totally on that, I could see that being, like, they shouldn't, you know, make it all about that, but it serviced the character and going forward. And so, and it was just an interesting that Lone Star guy was like, oh, you know, there's ghost stories or, you know, campfire stories about be careful or Cannibal Kara will get you. And I just thought it was interesting.
Excuse me a minute, David. I believe you meant Lone Star. Okay,
yes, so that's the proper pronunciation.
So that was just like every step of the way. I thought it was very, you know, if not, you know, super awesome, but at least it was interesting thoughts, interesting story that, you know, it wasn't, it didn't feel shallow. It didn't feel like, you know, there's a very thin characterization, very thin story. Like, there was a lot to this, to the characters, to the story. And it's like we get so much with Kara and her backstory, and I really like the family flashbacks. I just want to know more about T'Ling, and maybe, you know, on other adventures, we would learn more about her life story and how she got to where she is. But I really liked the Kara character.
Yeah, well, most
she grows
of this episode,
on you, yeah.
Yeah, most of this episode is definitely about Kara, and T'Ling mainly plays, like, you know, straight Vulcan to Kara's antics. Although I did think it was odd, like, the reason I was a little bit off with the cannibal plot isn't because I'm like, ew, gross, cannibalism. I'm of the opinion that if you need to survive, you do what you need to do to survive, and they're already dead. And I would figure that the Vulcans would actually be, she'd be like, look, they're dead. They don't care. There's nothing in that anymore. It's just meat now. The logical thing to do is to do what you have to do to survive. So that's not really the issue for me. It's just that, like, because cannibalism is so, like,
taboo.
Psychologically weighted to me, it distracted me a little bit from what was really important, which was that her family was dead, but now they're alive and she has a chance to see them again. But it's not really a problem. I do really like Kara, and I also, it's like, as someone who likes stories about female characters, and we don't get enough of those, especially in science fiction, like, I thought that was kind of neat. Yeah, I'll have both the main characters be female. I like that. And I think I like Kara's whole, like, trying really hard to be a grizzled space captain when she really is not a grizzled space captain. You know, she's like,
cute, man. And perky and bouncy.
She's like, we made our cargo run. It's time to go have drinks in a seedy bar, like space captains do.
Says, like, it's tradition. Don't you Vulcans have tradition? Well, here's another aspect of it that I liked the flashback scenes, because we get more of like that, what is driving that character, what's in her head, her motivations and everything. But it also gave another glimpse, like even more of a glimpse of life as a non-Starfleet, non-Federation, you know, officer, just life out in the space, in the galaxy. And it reminded me, like, you know, not the first couple times I watched it, of course, but later times, it reminded me of like when Travis Mayweather was like, you know, the space boomers, like the space families, where, you know, because in one point in one of the flashbacks, it shows that the parents are like on their little bridge doing their, you know, doing their flying the ship thing, and that they're hauling cargo, and young Kara, which I don't know, what would you guess, 12, like she's young but old enough, she has to do a spacewalk, and she's going out in a spacesuit, making sure the cargo is tied down.
You put your 12-year-old out there doing that? Why would you do that? Distracting to me.
Well, in a way it services the story, but you know, you can imagine that the mother and there's only like the mother and father and the couple kids, and so, you know, they're probably doing their flying the ship thing. But at the same time, I kind of had layer couple different thoughts of that. Is like, if you look at in the past and even up to today, if you had a family has a farm where it's like a family run farm, they put the kids to work. Like, the kid is out there.
But
you know,
this farm is the vacuum of space.
Well, and that's
space.
And that's where I thought it would be interesting to see that, you know, like the farm, that type of thing. But now you're in space, you know, now you're a trucker family or whatever, but in space, because it even a couple of their kids, but I could think like some kids would be totally deathly afraid of, you know, the vacuum of space and it goes on forever and all that. But then there'd probably be the kids. And I kind of even got the impression of that from Travis on Enterprise, like some kids would be into it, you know, like they show scenes of the weightlessness and she's like just humming her song, you know, floating along. And then as she's coming in, they even show her like doing a front flip. And so I could see like, once they get over the like, oh my God, I'm scared of like having to put on a suit, and it could almost be like diving underwater, you know, scuba diving or something. But now it's, you know, because you can't breathe under there, it's also like, you know, no oxygen. But
is that what I've been doing wrong when I stick my head in the water? Okay, now it all makes sense.
Right.
No, Oren, you're not breathing hard enough when you're underwater.
Breathe more. But I could kind of see a young kid could probably get over their initial fear and then kind of have fun, or just treat it as like, okay, we're, you know, going off to do the same thing we've done a million times. But so that was just a cool thing to see the family, you know, as the young kid. And then we see that in the alternate reality where they didn't die, like they're still doing it. They're still doing the hauling. So it'd be like, you know, the
family business.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Chateau Picard.
Yeah, I mean, sending her out in a spacesuit didn't really bother me because, like, you know, but I feel like by the time of Star Trek, a spacewalk is pretty mundane. That's like sending your kid out to go get some groceries, right?
Well, because it's a business, you know, like the whole thing with the farm, you know, there would be other kids where, you know, they're totally fine, you know, hauling the hay, feeding a big cow, or like doing something that is physically demanding or could be, you know, intimidating. Now, like, pluck a kid out of, you know, LA or New York that have never even seen a cow and say, go do this farm stuff. They would freak out, not be able to do it. But for the family that, you know, the kids that grew up doing it, it's like second nature. It's like no big thing to them.
Although a cow does scare me more than space. I'll admit that. I would go into space before I tried to deal with a cow.
That's very telling, Oren.
Cows are giant and, like, have, you know, mouths.
They
and
fall over and can't get up, though.
Yeah, but they're really heavy. They might
space
fall on
me. Space can't fall over.
Another thing, like you just said in the chat room, would you trust a 12-year-old? And the other thing that I thought, like, subconsciously at first, but then the more I watched it, is that was kind of also trying to inform that that character could handle it. Like, that's why she later becomes a captain of her own freighter ship. It's like, it wasn't just like, you know, some kid that would fumble and drop the wrench and the wrench goes flying off into space. Like, she was capable. Like, she could get things done even at a young age and not be intimidated or scared or inept. Like, it kind of made me think, like, oh, even at a young age, she was able to, you know, do the job and get it done.
What they didn't show you was all the times when that she did drop the wrench and the ship would just leave a trail of wrenches behind it. And be like, come on, Carrie, you got to stop dropping that wrench. Man, you guys don't appreciate my jokes.
Not yet.
No, not really.
I give it a 4 or 5. I don't know. Out of what, 10?
Out of whatever. So I gotta mention this real fast before I forget. My favorite scene in the episode is the scene when Kara's in the alternate universe. She's stolen the shuttle and she gets to her family's ship and it cuts from inside the, you know, the docking tunnel to outside of it, and there's no audio. And
we just see her freaking out over seeing her family and being super animated and excited.
Yeah, I thought that was actually
great. Yeah,
I really enjoyed that scene. That was probably the best scene in the episode for me.
Very creative, very well done, left a lot to the imagination, but you could still see how excited she was. And I thought that was also a really good benchmark for how high this guy's animation skill has come, because you see it, it doesn't look silly, you're feeling it, she's jumping around, waving her arms, it feels very, very natural. And again, a lot more sort of animated movement-wise than what we saw earlier.
I also thought he did a really good job with the Romulan warship. Like, that thing looked seriously menacing to me, you know, at least when I first saw it. I thought that was a great job.
Yeah, and initially, I thought, like, well, how come there isn't Starfleet coming after this Romulan ship? But at one point, if in the dialogue, they say that they've basically left Federation space, like they're out of the territory, basically. So they, like, that could be another, you know, interesting and dramatic thing, is like having these freighter captains be like, okay, we're in the safety of Federation space, and then their haul, you know, their job takes them outside of it, and now they have to fend for themselves. And that's why, you know, Romulans would be able to, you know, do that and then not have Federation just swoop in. And because that's the thing we always see in Star Trek is like, you know, the cavalry comes to the rescue and, you know, distress call. And then here comes a Starfleet ship. And in this case, they're kind of on their own. And, I mean, then we get to see, you know, the alternate Kara as a Starfleet officer. But that the main Kara story that we're seeing, like, they're just out on the you know, Outlands or however you want to, you know.
Kind of reminded me of the family in Aliens. You know? Out and on their, like, little frontier homestead thing in deep space trying to colonize. Anyone else think of that?
You mean, like, at the beginning of Aliens?
Before they're ruthlessly slaughtered by an alien, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that was part of the inspiration for this episode. If you read the guy's, like, the About page on his website, he talks about how the reason he made this was watching TOS and TNG, seeing all of the civilians that the Enterprise would run across, and then, you know, be like, what's up with those guys? What do they do? Which is actually, interestingly enough, sort of the same premise for Firefly, actually. And, you know, you can see some similarities here.
Definitely, especially with the sort of deep space trucking thing. That's kind of what they do, too.
Although I do really wonder what the economy of this future space works on. Because it's always weird when you think about, like, you know, theoretically the Federation doesn't use currency, so, like, how does that all work? That's an entire podcast in and of itself. I don't really think we can solve that today. It's just something that I wonder about whenever I see this sort of thing.
All right, one last thing I want to bring up, though, that was distracting to me. The sound quality kept switching around a lot, and you could hear it change with different characters talking, and that was really distracting for me. I don't know if that was just me or not. It was just something that I found very distracting, and also I wasn't crazy about the music.
Do you mean all across the board, like sound effects, music, and voicing, or was it just one?
Mostly with the voicing, it would just kind of, you know, switched quality a lot. It felt like it could have been mixed better.
I would guess that comes from probably the same problem that I have with Tales from the DMZ, which is that I don't have like a professional soundproof studio to record in. So
right.
Different recordings will sound different depending on what day I recorded them on, and if there were just like some kind of background story that I couldn't get, you know, that I couldn't filter out.
And then with Gates of Stovokor, another thing that we've dealt with is that even when we're all on the same recording together on the same day, we all have different computers with different mics and sound cards. But sometimes, you know, we're not able to make the meeting and recording session, and somebody has to record on their own and then send it in. And other productions where it's like not everybody is even in the same state, so they can't all meet at the same sound booth. So it's like different levels of recording that may vary. But that kind of brings to one thing I wanted to talk about, which is the voice acting. And even though there might be, you know, like tech issues of sound levels and that, I liked the voice acting. I think the weakest point would be Lone Star. I don't know how to do that right. But
and his weird, crazy space Tennessee accent.
Yeah, because it was an affected accent. It wasn't somebody, like, you know, naturally from the region that they're trying to depict. So
that was kind of distracting.
And a little overdone, you know. Like
it felt like going through for the low-hanging fruit on talking like a jerk.
Right, and we've seen that on other TV shows and movies and anime cartoon, whatever. So I could kind of forgive it again. Like, he was still an interesting enough character that, you know, had some, I don't want to say growth, but some movement. Like, it wasn't just a one-note type character. Like, you see that, you know, he's not just 100% jerk to, you know, insult her, where he, like, kind of gets playful at times and then gets concerned. And so there's a little bit to that character, but I would say, like, he would be the weak link of that chain. But the two main characters, Kara and Taling, I thought they did a good job, the voice actors for that, because they felt like an actual character. I mean, again, for some people it's tough to be Vulcan. Like, we, even on Star Trek itself, we've seen different people do, well, how does a Vulcan talk? What would they sound like? And, you know, whether it's, you know, obviously from Spock and TOS to TNG all the way to Voyager, like, there has been a couple of Vulcans where I thought, I don't buy it. Like, I don't, the actor is doing their best Vulcan voice or Vulcan tone, but not all of them were, like, hit it right for me. And so in this case, you know, the character is trying to be Vulcan, and I would think she talks just a little slow, you know, as Vulcan. Like, the tone and the mannerisms and everything is fine. I just think slightly a little bit, you know, slow tempo of it, but just barely. But the thing that is, I didn't know until just, like, researching for this show, was Kara was voiced by the wife of the animator, writer guy. So that was something interesting.
I was going to say go ahead, Grace.
Sorry, I wasn't crazy about the voice acting personally, but I felt like, for what it was all right.
I thought that the actress for Kara did.
What can I say?
Yeah, well, I thought the actress for Kara did a pretty good job. The only real complaint I had was that it was very obviously the same voice when she was pretending to be a child. But pretending to be a child is hard, and coaching actual children is also hard. But I thought she did a pretty good job. Taling is a little bit falling flat for me in the beginning. At least she gets better. You can see the improvement as
she
it goes.
She does talk really slow though at the start,
right? And that's a bit of an issue just when you're a Vulcan, right? And again, I have a Vulcan as a main character on Tales from the DMZ. Playing a Vulcan is hard. Like, you know, it's a lot of actors don't know how to do it in any way other than I'm gonna act really deadpan. And so, you know, I'm willing to extend them a little bit of credit on that. I actually think T'Leng does a lot better in the little the first episode, like the first bit of the next episode, which
I definitely agree with you on that.
I definitely wanted
to touch on that. For a long time I thought I want more of this, and then we see that there will be a bit more. But that was the thing, that he wrote the story. It took him 6 years to do the animation and all of it by himself. And then in one interview, they asked him, well, like, would you ever do it again? Would you do more? And he said he has more ideas for the characters and for the show, but that he was going to go off and do a couple other projects and then probably come back to it. So we're finally, I think it was in like some point in 2013 that we see it. And again, that's like how it worked on the first one, was that it was released in parts. And so we basically get part one of the next one that we could definitely talk about. But the thing about the voice acting, just to kind of wrap that up, was it could have definitely been better. But honestly, I mean, I'm part of an audio fiction, Gates of Stovalkor, that's based on Klingons. You do the Tales from the DMC. Trek Radio plays a bunch of different audio fiction dramas, you know, that have their own take on Star Trek and whatever. And there's different levels of quality, you know, that it's tough. You know, it's not easy for people that aren't in a professional studio working with each other and stuff. And there's been video games that have been like, you know, hit and miss. But one thing that he said was that, and I agreed with, was that in a way the animation is awesome. You're looking at it, but in a way the voice acting is very important, because that gives life to the characters, right? You know, they're basically little skeleton puppets that are walking around doing animation, you know, cycles.
That sounds terrifying, David.
Thinking like stick people.
That's going
to
haunt
my
nightmares, dude.
Robot. Because sometimes with animation, you just animate with like a stick figure that almost looks like a skeleton. And he described them as kind of robots because, you know, like robot, the big giant robot arms on a car factory assembly line, like, it's programmed to do a set number of movements, and it just does those moves. And that's how you kind of animate, is first you just animate the motions, and then once that's done, you import that into the rendering programs, and then it adds the heads and the faces and the hair and whatever. But what he was saying was, like, a lot of times, and it, you know, it's subjective or how much you're willing to give it, you know, let it go with it or whatever, but for all of voice acting, video games, what we do, everything, it's kind of like one of the most important parts, but the way he said it was, it's also one of the least appreciated at times, because when it's done right, people don't think about it. It's just, you know, they just go with it.
And
so that's where it's tough, you know, because sometimes it's the animation that'll take you out of it. But if there's bad voice acting, that'll take you out of it. But, you know, when it's done right, people don't realize it or don't focus on it. So it's kind of like, you know, the better you're at it, the less people think about it, which is kind of odd, but
I thought just a final act on the voice acting, I thought that Space Dad did a good job. I thought he was probably the best voice acted of them, and I also just appreciated his character, with the whole, like, him not being bothered that Kara was from an alternate universe, and just being like, no, you know, this is still in a way my daughter, so I still care about her. I thought, you know, that part was very touching, and I thought he acted it very well.
Right, yeah.
His name's not actually Space Dad. I've just forgotten what it actually
No, Space
was.
Dad works.
He's well, a dad in space.
Well, and another thing
dad
that I
in space.
Kind of give credit or give leeway is that, you know, aside from it being one guy doing all of it, you know, the animation, I mean, like, the, you know, just creating the 3D models, but then animating them, setting up the shots where you basically have to actually set up virtual cameras and then, you know, put the things in the right spot and lighting and all down the line, is that this was his first time doing it. He went to art school, but I think he also said, like, a lot of it was like drawing and other things that, so for the one guy doing it and for this being his first animation, like, job, I thought I was able to, you know, give some leeway and be forgiving, but also, like, I mean, obviously it could be better. And he even mentioned the Uncanny Valley, that he was thinking about that when designing the characters, and each person has their own, like, degree of it, like, where, what do they accept before it becomes that Uncanny Valley of realistic enough, but not realistic enough. So it's kind of like too real, but not real enough. So it makes it like weird or creepy. So he was saying, like, you know, some of the hair texture, some of the colors, the eyes and different, you know, things that he was trying to not go too far into that uncanny valley. And so there's a lot to deal with. I wanna definitely jump to the second one, but what would you be like your overall final impression? Like if somebody asked you, hey, have you ever heard of this, Aurora? What overall impression would you give to them? Would you recommend it? Which I definitely have tweeted about it, recommended it. But aside from just would you recommend it or not, what would you tell people that, you know, to expect, or what are your thoughts overall on the whole thing?
I'd say it's worth a watch for a little character exploration of the further Star Trek universe, just in, you know, life outside of Starfleet. And I'm really interested in seeing where they go, to see what they're able to do based on their improvement curve. I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. I would recommend people watch it. I think it's fun. It's not perfect, but what is, really? And I think that it has a lot of good stuff going for it. I'd be interested to see how this guy would work if he had an actual budget and wasn't just, you know, working on his own time, you know, with whatever resources he can put to hand.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and if you watch the credits, there are, you know, certain props are made by other people, like just the physical 3D model. So, like, you know, the hyperspray was made by one person, but for the most part, he assembled everything and put it together. And he, at one point in one of the interviews, he said, like, he wishes that they, like, it took him 6 years because it was just him, that if he had a team, you know, if there were six of him, it would have come out in 1 year. So it's like, you know, that's something to also think about, is, you know, being a one per, and but he also, it was kind of like a thought about pros and cons of being the only one doing it. And that was that because he was able to do it all of himself, he didn't have to worry about, you know, if you, you know, outsource some of the animation or a ship design or, you know, some of that, and it doesn't turn out right, it would be like more difficult to like tell that person, well, here's how you got it wrong, go do it over again, you know, and dealing with that. Where with him, he was able to make any changes he wanted along the way and improve it. And if things didn't work, he knew ahead of time, like as it happened, so he could stop. Because like, what if a person kept rendering and going further, and then you have to tell them all that work you just did is wasted because you got to start over and do something different. So that was a benefit. But then he also was saying, you know, being a one-man show had its drawbacks as well. So, you know, having a team would definitely help, but then it was interesting to see him, you know, a project where it's one person doing it all. And then it's also like he was mentioning at one point, like some of the software itself got upgraded, even though it was the same, you know, batch of programs, there would be, you know, they got better, there's plugins or things that got tweaked or updated. And so what he was able to do, what was doable would change over time. But so that was definitely, you know, I recommend it. It's about an hour, Star Trek Aurora. But then if you go look at the site, which is auroratrek.com, we see part one of the second Aurora, which now has a subtitle and involves a familiar character from the Star Trek universe, which I think is going to be very fun to see. But again, we get part one, so who knows how long, and that was posted in 2013. We'd have to wait to see when the next part comes out. But even just watching part one of the second one, the animation has improved. I mean, it's still not perfect. It's not Pixar doing it. But did you guys notice that watching the part one of the second Aurora production, like the animation and everything seems just
totally
a little bit
you already
better.
See a huge improvement.
Yeah, and I think the voice acting is better too. I think T'Ling, whoever the voice actress is for T'Ling, has a better handle on the character. And you know, Kara's still doing her thing of trying to be a grizzled space captain, even though she's not a grizzled space captain, which I find amazing. That's probably my favorite part of the opening of the second of the, you know, the new part one. And I think that the story is a little wonky, like where it goes, and I don't think we need to spoil this one. But I'm not sure if it's going to work exactly, but I still want to see. I want to watch it to see if it works.
Yeah, it piqued my interest to see, like, what's going to happen in part two that we... You know, to continue what happened in this one, because of something happens and it's like, what? And now it's like, how do they go forward with that?
Yeah, it's very curious. So now, let's see what happens here.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, David, since we've promoted the next episode and we've said what we wanted to say about the first one. I think you had some other Star Trek fan series that you wanted to recommend to the audience.
Well, over the years, there's different people have tried their hand at, you know, either fan fiction in all its forms. And so there's been written fan fiction, audio fan fiction, of course. And there has been a few fan animation things done. And some of them have been, like, various quality. And there have been some that I've bailed on because I thought, you know, no offense to them, they're doing something fun or they haven't been trained by Pixar. But there have been some animation, like computer animated things, that to me just look really, really bad. Like, you know, almost like worse than Second Life, and Second Life is way outdated. Like, just so some of that character, the models, the animation of other things have been really bad, to where we've seen the pros and cons and the, you know, the good and the bad of it. But there's another fan animation thing that is been put out there. Oh, because he said, the director, writer guy said, he was a big fan of, you know, Star Trek, the TOS, of course, but then he was a fan of the animated series, the Filmation Star Trek, you know, animated series. And that has its ups and downs, and, you know, that's a whole other story or show, but It was inspirational to him, and that he even mentioned that he enjoyed Star Trek Farragut, and that was another Star Trek animated series or you know, fan production that totally borrowed and continued the animation of the TAS, the animated series, to continue that. And so it has the same, it's like, you know, higher def now, I guess you could say, but it's basically the same animation from the animated series with the character faces and the colors and everything, but telling the story of a new ship, you know, or a different ship than the Enterprise, the Farragut. And so seeing that, and then seeing Aurora, it made me think, like, I definitely wanted to talk about Aurora and promote it and get more people to see it. Even if there was never a new one, I think this one was strong enough on its own that I like the story. Like I said, every now and then, months or a year will go by and it's like, I want to watch Aurora again. It's like, in a way, it's one of my, like, I don't know if I'll say most favorite, but it's one of my favorite among my top episodes of Star Trek. And that's just how I would think of it and look at it. Like, you know, it's good, cool Star Trek to me. It's fun, it's interesting, there's emotion. And so I wanted that, but then it also made me think, like, we see a lot of fan films being made, and a lot of them are really, really good, like, you know, feature film Hollywood style. Others you could see are more like, you know, a fan product, just, you know, fans doing their thing. But it made me think that when we're looking at Star Trek with JJ, the 2009, and then Into Darkness, and then they're thinking, okay, after the third one, we want Star Trek back on TV. And even Orci and a few of them were saying, let's do an animated series, and bringing up Clone Wars, and we see kind of a lot of animated things coming out. Clone Wars, we're going to get Star Wars Rebels. And then, to me, I really, really love Tron Uprising, which is the computer animated series based on Tron. I think that's
good
as
stuff.
Good. It's awesome. I mean, to me, that, I don't want to call that a cartoon. It's like, it's basically film quality, like the story, the acting, the animation,
and
everything.
It worked really well with the Tron aesthetic, I think.
Right. It added to the lore and the mythos and the universe. Like, it didn't seem like a step down. It didn't seem like cheesy or watered down or anything. And that made me think, like, with all of these fan productions coming out, they got good stories or good ideas. And, you know, a lot of times they even try to cast, you know, good actors, but even Hollywood actors at times. And that just made me think, like, why not make some of these upcoming and you know, proposed fan films as animation? Because Star Trek Aurora was done, like, you know, it started way long ago. Like, if you look at it on YouTube or whatever, it says 2 years ago. So if you count back from, like, 2 years is when it would have finished, and then count back six, that's, like, that's a long time ago. And, you know, off-the-shelf software and even just techniques of, you know, Clone Wars and Tron Uprising, like, there's more out there now that if somebody were to start a new one, they could, like, use that as either the competition or the inspiration to the like, where the bar is set. And that just made me want to, like, bring up the story or the idea or the topic again of, like, new Star Trek, but let's get Star Trek animation, like, to be a strong thing again, you know? Like,
yeah, why not?
Because if this one guy could do it all on his own, like, at his own house, if we had a team of people to, like, banding together, getting a budget, like a lot of these fan films do, a Kickstarter, an Indiegogo, or, you know, try to make it feature film Hollywood quality, like, I wish more people would do that for animation. You know, it's like, I want to see Richard Hatch as a Klingon in Axanar. I want to see Tim Russ in Renegades. But, you know, some of these could also be really awesome as an animated Star Trek. So it's just like, I don't know. It obviously, we can't just say, hey, stop your film production and turn it to animation. But if more people could watch these animated shows and get jazzed by it, maybe we could start to see some, you know, really high quality animation for the Star Trek universe.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I've been very vocal before that I would love a Star Trek animated series, that especially now with the improvement in technology, I feel like the original Star Trek animated series didn't work very well because it was just so expensive that they had to do these really short episodes and they had to reuse a bunch of frames, and you can really tell. I mean, in some frames, if you're watching, you can see like a fingerprint flash across the screen because they just were like, no, we have to reuse everything. But I would love to see modern animation for like a Clone Wars style show, especially because Clone Wars was really sneaky. Clone Wars got around this whole, you know, cartoons have to be for kids, so they have to be 22 minutes long because children are stupid and have short attention spans. And that's not my logic. That's studio
logic.
They made
it a serial series also.
Yeah, that's how they got around that. By being like, well, fine, you say we have to do 22-minute episodes, we'll make a 5-part, you know, story that is 22 minutes, you know, parts. And then it all, you know, and Justice League of America actually did the same thing. Like, almost every episode in that show is a 2-parter. So it's basically a bunch of 45-minute episodes. And I think that would be great. If, you know, I would love to see Star Trek with full-length animated episodes. I think that would be fantastic.
Be cool.
Well, because I just thought, you know, all along the past, I mean, I would even like to see a cell, like, you know, cell hand-drawn type animation, like, you know, like the TAS, the animated series from Filmation. I'd like to see more of that. I mean, it doesn't have to be CG. If it's done well, you know, we could enjoy some cartoon, quote-unquote, you know, level animation if the story and the content is good. But once it reaches into the CG, and in both cases, whether it's hand-drawn or, like, cell-animated, you know, because they still use computers for that, where it's, like, looks 2D flat, but it's animated, or, you know, full 3D wireframe model CG, it just opens up, you know, for more potential of, like, because if you look at TOS, the original series, and then look at the animated series, in some cases, the animated series, you know, there's a drop in quality or story or whatever, but they do some elaborate, very imaginative, like, monsters or sets, or just, you know, they're able to do more with animation that I think would open up the imagination of a lot of these fan films, where instead of it being like, you know, more of Kirk and Spock on the bridge, you know, they could do more in space or more aliens or do more craziness. But it was interesting that because of the software that was used for Aurora, in one of the interviews, he said that he had to still be conscious of minimalism, you know, like get it down to what's needed. And he couldn't just have like 50 characters on the screen all jumping up and down and doing, you know, and because if it was Star Trek, it would work at times because it was Star Trek is a lot of sitting and talking or talking and walking and talking. And, you know, then you get the ships and all that. It's not like, you know, everybody jumping around, like a, you know, doing either dance choreography or fight choreography, like, especially because it was one person in his case. But So, I mean, there's the pros and cons of both, but with a, you know, good team and a good program and taking it more seriously, like you said, not for kids. It's not just like a, you know, SpongeBob or something. It's like trying to make a serious...
Let's not diss on the SpongeBob unless we have to.
Well, you know what I mean. It's like, you know...
I know what you mean, though, yeah.
So if you're, it's like, if it's going to be like film quality and, you know, on par with good Star Trek, I think it would just be, you know, interesting to see more in an animated capacity, because it would give those people room to create, you know, aliens that don't just look like a human with a couple pieces of rubber on their face, or, you know, interesting planets and scenarios and everything. So I definitely, you know, it's a double-edged, like a multiple goal agenda, I guess, because I wanted to talk about Aurora, but also get more people thinking of, you know, more seriously or just more in general, like, hey, let's get some animated Trek. I think it would be very cool.
Yeah, I love the idea of animated Trek. My only concern, and the reason why I could see them not maybe not wanting to do it, is just because in the United States there is such a prevailing attitude that animation is for children. Like, it's not correct, but it does exist, and so if you were looking at it from, you know, the realities of trying to sell a Star Trek show, you might have a problem with that. But I really hope
if that were to come from one of the from CBS Paramount, but with a lot of the fans out there, because another thing I thought is, what if we took like Tales from the DMC or Gates of Stovokor or Star Trek Outpost or a lot of the good audio fictions, where they have good characters, good voice acting, and like have an animated episode, you know, like it would be really cool to see a lot of the animated, the audio dramas. You see it in your mind's eye, but a lot of times it'd be really cool. Like, I want to see that on my screen. So it's just, you know, from the fan community, I can't do it. You know, maybe it's not everybody could do it, but there's a lot of talented people out there, especially in the Trek community, that like, I would love to see more fan productions from, you know, and that way you could get comedy, you could get drama, but like, you know, the difference between Aurora CG animation and then Star Trek Farragut animated series, where it looks like TAS, I think just having more diversity and more, you know, people doing it would just, you know, open up a lot of avenues for people.
Maybe the fact that we haven't seen more fan animation is just sort of a branch off of the idea that we still have, that's this set concept of what animation and cartoons are supposed to be, that kind of limits what people think should and can be animated.
Well, also, right. I think we'll just see more as animation software becomes
God,
cheaper.
God, let's hope so, yeah.
And easier to use and
I'm
more readily available.
I'm excited to see the future of this.
Well, especially because if it does come from the fan community or, you know, independent film community, you might get stuff that the studios would never put out, even if it was on film. Because look at Star Trek Renegades. They're kind of going in a darker tone, right? Like, it's not your father's Star Trek, or however you want to put it. Like, they're going in directions that, you know, are not the classic tone for Star Trek. And now, if you go with animation, it could go, like, almost rated R, or it could go darker and go in directions that the studios would never take it. Because, like, one of the a lot of times when you're talking about when we're saying animation that's not for kids, one of my most favorite animations of all time, like series and productions, was when HBO did the Spawn cartoon. And that wasn't even CG, it was like hand drawn cartoon, but it had an art style that was different than, you know, most other cartoons that have been out. And it had a hard tone to it. Like, people got told, like, it was Spawn. Full on Spawn, like way better than that movie that came out. So if people are
pretend the Spawn movie never happened, okay?
I'm good with that.
Just purge it from your memory. Purge it.
But you know what I mean? Like, what if there was a Klingon animated series where they were able to actually show Batleths and what a Batleth would do to a body, instead of the TV shows where it's almost like swinging a stick? You know, it's like, people, there would be, you know, limbs being hacked off, there would be blood. The studios are never going to do that, whether it's TV or a movie. They're never going to really do a rated R Star Trek. At least I don't think they would. But if there was a fan company, like a fan production, an independent film, they could totally go in different directions like that. Or what if it's, you know, something that explores Now, this is could open up a whole other can of worms, but like, what if it were to explore a little bit more of the sexual nature of Star Trek and things that have hinted at and mentioned, but we never are going to see it because it's, you know, nudity. Oh my God. You know, on TV or in
that
the movies.
That simply won't do. Violence, right. Yes. Nudity, no.
We cannot show the sex. It would be incorrect.
Right.
The sex.
But if it, I mean, obviously, like, you know, actual movie studios or companies, they're doing interesting things on HBO now, Showtime, Cinemax, Star, all these, you know, Game of Thrones and, you know, all the different Walking Dead and stuff, like, where it's, there's nudity and violence all over the place, but still good story. I just think, you know, it would be interesting to see some really good animation from the fan independent film, because it could take Trek in all these different directions that are kind of like the groundwork is there, the seeds are planted, but we'll just never see it from the studios. And a lot of times, even though the fan independent films are really good and they're getting better and better each time, some stuff is just hard to film. Like, you got to build it out of, you know, plywood and make the costumes and do the makeup. Like, I just really wish there was a lot more coming out of animation on all levels, whether it's like different art styles, different, you know, tone of approach, like the way they approach the tone of Trek. Because I think Trek is so diverse. There's so much to it that it could handle it. Like, what if there's just off the top of my head, what would a Paklet animated cartoon show be? You know, then there'd be the freighter captain all down the line. So I just, you know, I want to encourage, you know, the community that even if it is somebody drawing it by hand and like animating it with Photoshop or something, like, let's get more animation going. Cause I love, you know, even puppetry and, you know, but it was just something that I always enjoy seeing creative, good storytelling. And when it's a cartoon or a CG, that just makes me more like nerd out about it. Like, ooh, look at this. This is like cool or interesting.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I do think this is a good place for us to call it an end of the show for today. I actually have to get going and help someone take apart bird cages. But thank you, David, for recommending this to us. And I could not agree more with your impassioned call for more Star Trek animation. I think that would be
and
really
another,
cool.
And another, just real quick, another sure. Shout out at the Animatrix for the Matrix trilogy. Like, that added
to the
world. It was not for kids. It was like serious. Animation. Get to it, you know, make it so.
And Grace, so Dave and I have been talking a lot recently. Final thoughts from you on this?
Well, like David said, this is probably a pretty good call to action to see more animation in Star Trek and in fan work in general. And again, I'm excited for the future. I'm excited to see more animation out there. So get to it, people. Make it happen. And
right, well,
I'm excited to see what happens with Star Trek Aurora. I have high hopes for them.
Oh, wait a minute. We didn't mention it real quick. The next upcoming Aurora is going to include Harry Mudd. How could you go wrong? I definitely want to see that. So we'll keep an eye on it, keep everybody updated. Maybe at some point as we get further into the next Aurora, maybe we could bring him on and do a quick interview with him. That would be fun.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. I hope you guys will join us next week when we will be doing what's probably going to be a long episode, as we are going to be talking about the law in Star Trek, and we will have a real-life lawyer on the show, if everything goes well, to help us discuss it. Until then, this will be All Things Trek, signing off.